welcome to another episode of Robbinsdale Revisited. We're here today talking about the 1920s. I have a book called Robbinsdale Then and Now by Helen Blodgett, and she introduces the decade by saying it was remembered by many as the very best decade of their lives. The war to end wars was over, and times were booming until the stock market crash in 1929. Many people got their first radios, Model Ts were replacing horses, and the flappers were in style. And short dresses for the first time in history, we think. The Charleston was the popular dance, and women bobbed their hair, thus no longer needing to brush it 100 strokes every day. Gas stoves were replacing the old iron wood stoves, and gas furnaces began replacing coal furnaces. So we'll talk about all of that and more today with the president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, Pete Ritchie. He'll tell us a little bit about flappers, the jazz age, prohibition, and growth in the area. There's even a bank robbery around one Christmas, and the Robbins Tea House is taking off. Some other local landmarks are Mueller opens a movie theater, and the Sacred Heart School opens, and more.
So I've been thinking a lot about the 1920s. It was just a decade that was very exciting in Robbinsdale. And the city really grew. So, you know, at about 1920, you're looking at maybe 1,100 people. And by the end of the decade, you're looking at more like 4,500 people. So not a huge place, but it also seemed bigger than it was because you had this business district and it was the only place where you could do your shopping, go to the bank, you know, between, say, North Minneapolis and Osseo. There just wasn't much else. So it was sort of a center of commerce. And you also had some businesses that were attracting a lot of attention. Captain Billy's Fawcett Publishing is the first thing that comes to mind. And this was employing a fair amount of people by the time you get to about 1924. You know, I love Sinclair Lewis, and Babbitt is one of my favorite books. And they always talk about boosters in Babbitt and how Minneapolis, he calls it Zenith, but Minneapolis had this crowd of people that would say, come to Minneapolis. It's just such a great spot. You're going to love it here. And Robbinsdale had its crowd of boosters, too. I think of the Library Club, which was a group of 20 or 30 women at the time, and the founding daughters of the city, Edith and Amy, were very active in the Library Club. And the Library Club, you know, was always running around promoting themselves as an important women's club, held their meetings in what was the city hall. And eventually they got a little library set up right here where this library is now, or the Historical Society. They did a great job just convincing their husbands to go around promoting the city as a place that was cultural. And we had all these organizations, the Westfall American Legion got started here, and they became very active. And between the Library Club and the American Legion, and you had a Girl Scout troop start, and you just had all sorts of activity. And the real estate people were doing their best to develop Robbinsdale as a suburb, which was always Andrew B. Robbins' vision. I'm looking at a Northern Headlight newspaper, and this is dated September 17th, 1924. And the entire front page is just, you know, business keeps pace with population, the story of growth and beautiful Robbinsdale. And you have advertisements for Howard Lumber and all the big buildings that were being built at the time, the Robbinsdale Creamery, the Masonic Temple. And it's always interesting to see that, you know, this is the 1920s, and the city's really hasn't been around all that long. But they're writing their history, and they want to tell you about Andrew B. Robbins, the first mayor. Of course, they were village presidents at the time, but we just called them mayors. And then, you know, they talk about the second mayor and Thomas H. Gerling, the former mayor, Henry Ogham, the current mayor, and Howard, who was in charge of Howard Lumber, and he was a village president, too. And then they just have this little poem on the front page that I'm going to read. It says, come, ye jaded urban mortals, out along the thoroughfare to the country's open portholes, where there's sunshine and fresh air. For that is the tonic legal and of favored wide renown, and the moonlight is right regal in this grand suburban town. Here outside the sordid city, just beyond the dirt and din, lies our village quiet and pretty, welcoming the wearied in. Here are no crowded streets and alleys, no smoky pall overhead. Here are nature's hills and valleys, clear blue skies and stars instead. Come, ye city cynics all, trek out over the winding trail. Nature's voices join the call. Welcome to our Robbinsdale. You know, there's all these descriptions of Robbinsdale as, you know, we're not very far away from downtown and we have our own streetcar line. And when you think about it, you know, being, say, 27th Avenue North is, if you think about what that means when you're in South Minneapolis, well, 27th is, you know, down there by almost to Lake Street. So if you think about Lake Street as being close to downtown, which it's relatively close, Robbinsdale is really almost that close too. We're a little bit over to the west, but downtown Minneapolis isn't far. So this would be the perfect little bedroom community. The decade in 1920s, of course, opens up. You've got Victor Memorial Drive. The parkway is now being extended and it will head over to the river and the ground rounds are being thawed out and Theodore Wirth is planting trees all over, which was something Andrew B. Robbins was big on too. And the Minneapolis Park Board even has some designs on Crystal Lake and that's discussed. The neighborhoods are starting to be platted out and filled in as the population keeps growing. The 1920s are also bookended by some bank robberies that were kind of exciting. The first one, you know, being right at the opening of the decade, you've got a man who the newspapers, right after the crime occurs, was destitute and poor, and he'd lost his job, and he was in a tough place, and he decided to rob the Robbinsdale Bank. And the newspapers also point out that his daughter was at home, you know, hoping for a Christmas present. And here is this poor man, this poor father, decides he's going to rob the Robbinsdale Bank. He's got a pistol. He goes into the bank. He demands some money. He gets it. Alarm bells, you know, are sounding. And the teller goes and grabs the Justice of the Peace, who isn't very far away. He gets his pistol out and he chases the bandit. And orders him to stop. He continues to flee. The bandit tells him, you know, you better turn around and go the other way or you're going to get it. And starts running again. And the Justice of Peace, whose name was Crandall, shoots him in the back. And the bandit dies. Then the newspapers, as they start telling a story, really emphasize the where this man was at in his life and how troubled he was. And that sort of, you get a little bit of a backlash, some letters to the editor about, well, you know, this man was robbing the bank and stealing people's life savings. And you kind of remember this is before FDIC. And once that money was gone, nobody was going to replace it. And so they, on the one hand, there was all this sympathy for the bandit. On the other hand, there was, you know, people saying, you know, you can't judge the Justice of the Peace, Crandall, for shooting this man because he was doing his duty. And it goes back and forth. And I just think it's so interesting because we imagine, or I think lots of people imagine, that in this day and age, if this happened, if a policeman shot somebody who was fleeing in the back or fleeing with money, you know, how would that go? How would that story play out? And I think we imagine that in the 1920s, that it would just play out like, you would say, well, that's what bandits get. That's what they deserve. And it really wasn't that way. The amount of sympathy for this man is kind of incredible. And of course, the people that were defending Crandall are, you know, people like the American Legion, the patriotic organizations. And it was, and they rightfully pointed out that, you know, this guy just could have well have shot the Justice of the Peace the other way too. Not exactly self-defense, but it kind of a, you know, there's a long history of bank robberies in Robbinsdale. Sometimes, you know, they rob you with a six gun. And in the words of Woody Guthrie, sometimes they rob you with a fountain pen. We talked about the bank teller embezzling thousands of dollars before the bank had to close for a little while, just before the 1920s. And some of the other bank robberies where you had a bunch of kids that were reading not a comic book, but an illustrated book about Jesse James. And they were inspired and they went into the bank with a toy gun and demanded billions. And that got them in the newspaper. There was also a group that was going to strap dynamite to the safe and they were breaking into the bank. And the story is that a 12-year-old girl named Ruth Trump and climbed to the bell tower in the city hall and rang the bell as a warning as her father went and assembled the villagers and they chased them out of town. Not quite as dramatic as the Jesse James gang down there in Northfield, but that was the Robbinsdale answer to that story. But so the town is bustling and growing. And, you know, if I just kind of think about what we had going on, if I think in terms of what was going on in downtown Robbinsdale in our busy business district that was always serving North Minneapolis and Osseo and all the farmers out west. So if you're up there at 42nd and West Broadway, and about this time in the 1920s, the street names were changed so that they reflected the street names in Minneapolis. West Broadway had been Crystal Lake Road, although that also extended into Minneapolis. We can say Regent Avenue was College Avenue after the Lutheran Seminary that burned down. You had Noble Avenue. Was changed. It was previously Billes Avenue and so on. All the streets in Robbinsdale were changed to correspond with North Minneapolis. And we get that wonderful alphabet street where, you know, North Minneapolis kind of begins with Xerxes. And as you go back, York, Obit. And of course, as you extend that all the way south, those streets are in South Minneapolis too. Here at 42nd West Broadway, you know, if I look up the street in my 1920s mind, What I can see is on one corner, we got a brand new gas station. It's not Sipes, but it's a little brick building. If I look to the east, there is a creamery, which people still remember as having wonderful ice cream. It changed hands a couple times over the years. In the 1930s, it was probably best known as the Johnson Dairy, and then it was a Purity Dairy. And if I look beyond that, we got the Masonic Temple, which is still standing. And they didn't own the building until many years later. They had a mortgage burning ceremony, and it was the original owner. They were having a little trouble making payments. And he said, well, if you guys can't, you know, make the payments on this at some point, maybe we'll make it a nightclub, which I wonder what a nightclub would have been at the height of Prohibition. But that's what the landlord would threaten the Masons with. But eventually they got their bills settled. On the other side of the street there, you have the Trump House. The Trumps owned a hardware store on the main drag there. And they rented boats still down at Twin Lake that you could go to the hardware store and get the oars and bait and then go down to Twin Lake and spend the day fishing if you wanted. And beyond that, you had the Robbins Tea House, or sometimes it's referred to as the Jefferson Highway Tea Shop. And this was a really beautiful little house. And Amy and Edith Robbins, it's said, went down to the quarry and picked out boulders to give it this rustic look. And so it had stone fireplace, great big stone fireplace. And we have pictures at the Historical Society of meetings being held that, and it was huge on the inside and out. There was a stone fireplace on either end. And then you had some stone walls and pillars on the driveway. It was just a pretty little house, and that's where they did business. It was used as a guest house. They did have a little tea shop in there, and you could come in and get some tea. It's the 1920s where, you know, all saloons are closed, so maybe they thought they were going to attract some people to sit down and have tea with them. But they also handled the Robbins, the Andrew B. Robbins Estate, which was their real estate business. And the address there was 4422, still calling it Crystal Lake Avenue, but eventually that was West Broadway. As we come down the street a little bit and we look to the west, we have Howard Lumber, and he's doing a booming business, and it hasn't burned down yet, but we know it'll burn down at least three times because the railroad goes right through there and there's still puffer bellies going through and they're belching out sparks, and you just happen to have a lumber yard both on the north and south side of the tracks. You've got these lumber yards. And then a little bit further in, you have a print shop, which this paper we mentioned here, the Northern Headlight, is being printed. And as we head down to our main part of our street, in the late 1920s, it's called the Crystal Theater is built. And this is Mueller, who had a drugstore, William Mueller. And he, you know, had put a soda fountain in there, nice brick building. And then he extended the sidewalk to the west and built his 300-seat movie theater. It eventually becomes the Robin Theater, but initially it was the Crystal Theater, always owned by Mueller there. And at some point, probably not in the 1940s, it changes ownership a couple of times, and it's eventually owned by the Volk brothers, who in the 1920s had just, you know, come in from Lithuania and were starting their theater business. On the other side of the street, we still got our blacksmith, and he might not be shoeing a lot of horses at this point, but he still seems to find plenty of work. And people that can still remember that always talk about that the kids like to gather up and watch him do his business there. And as we go down the east side, West Broadway, we've got a cafe that is sometimes called Zim's Cafe. Later, it's called Wagner's Cafe. And we know that they had a little hole punched through to the Fawcett Publishing Building, and that they would hand sandwiches through that if the reporters and the people creating content for Captain Billy's Whiz Bang and True Confessions magazine and Triple X magazine and all these pulp magazines Captain Billy was putting out, we know that they were handing sandwiches through so that those guys didn't have to leave their desk and can just stay put and get their work done. Also on that side of the street, we got a barber shop. Baudoin is the barber's name, and you can still see his name up on top of that building, which later became the Robbinsdale Municipal Liquor Store. And Nana Rosa's restaurant was there for years, and it's been a few things, but that building's still standing there. As we continue down the street, we've got the village hall, but by this time we've added a little garage and we got our first fire truck, and that comes in 1926. You know, in every era of Robbinsdale's history, there's these big fires that come and wipe out, you know, a few buildings and sometimes even a block at a time. Next to that, you got next to Captain Billy's, first you have the bank building in the early 20s. Bank building goes down, Fawcett Publishing Building goes up. It's originally just two stories. You got the bank on the first floor and Captain Billy's publishing up on the second floor. Eventually they add a third floor, and that's where Captain Billy and his brother Roscoe have their apartments. A little more office space up there. Then you have the Urban Block, which is our hardware store now. And Gus Urban owned that block, and various businesses went in out of there. Shoe stores, another hardware store, paint store. Continuing down, you have Sipe's first gas station. And of course, we still have a Sipe gas station here in Robbinsdale. So it's over 100-year history of Sipe there. Continuing down the block, you've got a few other little businesses open up, and then Sacred Heart School gets built in the 1920s. Sacred Heart's Church, which was a wooden structure, gets a brick facade on the other side of the street. Then you have your meat market, you have the Robbinsdale Grocery, the building that becomes Adolph's Bar goes up, and you've got, of course, you don't get to have bars in the 1920s, so it wasn't a bar yet. And then the three-story Columbia Hotel was still there. It was also called the Georgia Hotel. It was always sort of a temperance hotel, so Prohibition again isn't affecting them, but they managed to stay busy as a rooming house and a place where when people are visiting Fawcett Publishing, they can stay, and he is known to have put some people up there. And then you have a little car dealership, but it was called Jack's Chevrolet. Eventually, you get a two-story building that stood until the 80s. That was a doctor's office and a knick-knack store and various other things. So Robbinsdale's got this busy business district, and all these people tend to know each other, and they form a little business association, and they put on plays. And of course, one of their favorite things to do when they put on a play, and a lot of times these are done over at the school, is get as many of the businessmen as possible to dress up as women. And sometimes there's a play that called for just two men dressed up as women, but they decided to make the entire play. It's almost like as if we're talking about Shakespeare times, where there just are no women actors. It's all men dressing up as women and pretending to be them. But it helps, you know, when you have your local grocer dressed up, who doesn't want to come out and see a play like that? And so Robbinsdale is just this bustling place. And of course, what puts us on the map is Captain Billy's Whiz Bang. And, you know, the magazine just starts out with a bang. You know, he's running around to hotels downtown trying to get it on their newsstands. He's got his kids out with wagons and they're going through the neighborhood trying to sell it like a newspaper. And they're downtown too. We know that he had at least one residence over in Golden Valley. We're always looking for where his house might have been in Robbinsdale, but we know he had one here, and he eventually moves into his own building in downtown. He often refers to the Robbinsdale farmhouse, so whether or not it was just in town, it's hard to say. Whenever there's a family that has set up a farm or a truck farm, they always list their address as Robbinsdale, even if they're 5 miles away, because this is, you know, the only place. Nobody thinks of themselves as being in Crystal Lake Township or Crystal Village. They just think of themselves as being part of Robbinsdale because this is the thing that's on the map. We mentioned probably the only African-American family in the area was the Wright family, and their farm was sort of by where Forest Elementary is, so it's all the way out there in Crystal, but they always refer to Robbinsdale. And we know that Martha Wright actually went to school here and that eventually graduated from North, because we didn't have a high school. So he went to school up to eighth grade here, and then he went over to the North High. But our school was expanding. They added wings all through the teens. They added another little wing on the 20s, and there was always a push to get a high school here, but it didn't happen during the 1920s. And as much as Robbinsdale was growing at the time, what was still holding us back is we didn't have some of the infrastructure that North Minneapolis had. We didn't have the water system. We didn't have the sewer system. The roads weren't quite as good. Many were paved. We had some sidewalks. But we were starting to fill in, and, you know, it was, you know, quite a few homes were built. The Robbins sisters were just one of the many real estate interests that were in town. The Sanborn family was selling lots around what is now Sanborn Park, and that name may change due to their use of racial covenants on all the lots they were selling. The other big development was in the south of the city. That was McNair Manor, and just the amount of advertising for this was astounding. They were full-page ads in the newspapers almost every week. You know, in order to sort of combat the idea that Robbinsdale didn't have a water and sewer system, they built their own water tower, and that was about at the top of 26th and McNair, and we call that place Tanker Hill now because of that water tower. The water was of poor quality, and the city kept testing it and telling them that, and by the 1930s, they had to tear that down. They had their own little water tower there, and part of McNair Manor was also in Golden Valley, and part of it, a little sliver of it, was in Minneapolis, too. But, you know, it was a grand design. You had a boulevard with a little island in it that's still there at Zenith Avenue, and you had some curved streets that went around and around as you went back toward what I'm just going to call the Robbinsdale Ravine, although I'm, and we'll get to that in a minute, but I'm not sure. You know, there's been different names. When I was growing up, we called it the Valley, but there's just a spot, a steep spot where the land kind of gives way behind St. Margaret Mary's Church and continues north all the way up to where Trabilla is. Now that's Sahaki Park, of course. And then as you go to the west, we had Robbinsdale Home Gardens, and there were all these patriotic advertisements about moving into that neighborhood, that you were going to be self-sufficient and you can have your chickens here, and you know, you've got big lots, and maybe you're going to buy the lot next door to you too, so you can plant a few vegetables and be self-sufficient and do this thing that you can't do in the city. You got all this fresh air and you got a little more elbow room, and just, you know, the, I guess if you get into the 1970s or something, you would call it a hobby farm, but they were marketing themselves that way. Whenever you're dealing with these big real estate companies, with the possible exception, because I haven't found anything, of the estate of Andrew B. Robbins, run by his daughters, they are all riddled with racial covenants. The Sanborn families were the strangest and longest, because they listed all the ethnicities that were not going to be allowed to buy there. In addition to that, at Robbinsdale at the time, there's Klan activity starts appearing. And what we've got in terms of sources around the Historical Society for this is Helen Blodgett's book, Robbinsdale Then and Now, talks about the Klan marching down in West Broadway in hoods and robes, kind of full regalia, and how terrified everybody was of this. They were scared. She credits Floyd B. Olson with putting an end to Klan activity in the area. It's hard to see how he did that. I know he was a Hennepin County attorney, and he also had a relationship with Captain Billy, and Captain Billy was always nervous about organized crime or the Klan. Helen Hartig's History of Robbinsdale also discusses the Klan activity at the time and mentions cross burnings about where North Memorial Hospital is. And then you get to a strange article in the newspaper in 1924, where the Ku Klux Klan votes to disband, and they mention that they have this vote in the Robbinsdale Ravine. They mention that the chapter of the Klan had 6,000 members and that they were out of step with the imperial officer in Georgia who had come up to have a visit with them. Then they have this meeting and they vote to disband, and it's, you know, the headline across the Minneapolis Tribune, but they don't mention what happens next. And, you know, there's been various people that will come into the Historical Society and say that they're that they knew a family member that was involved with the Klan. It's really hard to find anything past the 1920s until you get into the 1950s, where a Klan leader that got in trouble named Stevenson in Indiana because he raped a young woman and was sentenced to prison. Somehow he's let out on parole accidentally. He flees to Minnesota and gets a job at the Robbinsdale Post. At some point, you know, the newspaper is printing an ad that says, "Have you seen this man? Because the Indiana prison system wants him back. The old man of the Klan," he's called, the Stevenson fellow. Timothy Egan actually wrote a book just about him and his activities and just the evil character that he was. Anyway, you know, his coworker looks over at him and says, "That's the old man of the Klan right there," notifies the Robbinsdale police. They can pick him up, and he gets put away again. You know, this question comes up from time to time. That's really, you know, all we've got in terms of documentation about Klan activity in Robbinsdale. We know that that there was a lot of fear in the community, particularly among the Catholics at Sacred Heart.
Pete, when you talk about the membership in the Klan, mm-hmm. there's sort of a regional chapter and then maybe a local chapter. So I think the regional chapter is much bigger, right? That's the 6,000 number.
But yeah.
What do we know about the local chapter?
Not that much, you know. I mean, I'm thinking that the 6,000 number is encompassing, you know, North Minneapolis, Robbinsdale. And what I've always wondered about this meeting in the ravine, because we just have such sketchy details about it, is how many people were there and how do you do this at night? Do you have a show of hands? How, and, you know, why vote to disband? You know, just like you have that big an argument with whatever's this officer from Georgia reading that article. It's sort of like you don't understand what the disagreement is or why they choose to disband. And obviously they, even if that chapter disbanded, maybe it was absorbed by a neighboring chapter or... We're always looking for a little more information about that, and it's just a little misty, you know?
Yeah, and it's just one of many civic organizations. I don't know if you'd call it a civic organization, but there are other groups around, like the Masons and
right.
the American Legion.
Yeah, and we know that Kid Can had some very close relations with one of Captain Billy's wives. It, you know, becomes a bigger problem after they get divorced in the 1930s, and she's kind of holding court in a hotel room in downtown Minneapolis, and Kid Can is visiting her, and she points out a journalist that is a problem for Kid Can, and she points him out to him, and he's murdered. And then that goes through the court, issues an accessory to murder, and Captain Billy is, of course, mentioned a lot, but by that time, they don't have much to do with each other. And what we know about Captain Billy is, you know, in various pulp magazines, one time he brings out a special issue just about Al Capone. And it's, and he's very concerned because he wasn't just flat, you know, it wasn't a flattering special issue. It was about organized crime. It was about Al Capone. And Captain Billy is just as nervous as a cat that he's going to suffer some sort of retribution. He has tried to avoid organized crime as best he can. He wanted to serve liquor at his resort up in Breezy Point, and he arranged to get it flown in. But mobsters were always coming around saying, "I can supply you with liquor." Well, Captain Billy knew enough pilots. He was Canadian himself. He had connections, so he took care of his own liquor needs. But the mobsters didn't like that. They wanted to make some money off this, you know, thing at Breezy Point, too. Who knows what he was up to in Robbinsdale? I can't believe that Fawcett Publishing was someplace that was dry. I just imagine these guys all had flasks in their desks, and maybe they met after work in the basement. It's hard to say where a speakeasy was. But Captain Billy was so concerned that he was going to anger the mobsters, and probably, you know, was concerned he would anger the Klan, too. And so he had Pinkerton guards after his special issue about Al Capone posted around the building here on West Broadway. As it turned out, Capone wrote him a letter thanking him and for this, you know, wonderful, flattering portrayal of his crimes. So Captain Billy didn't have that much work to worry about from Al Capone, but he was just, I think he was always very cautious, and he was rich. So maybe that was just part of it too, that he was worried that that he was going to anger the wrong group. And, you know, his reach with the Whiz Bang magazine, with True Confessions, these magazines were selling millions of copies around the country. And, you know, he did touch on a lot of social issues, a lot of the content. I mean, he would have contests, send me in your story to True Confessions and we'll publish it. And some of these stories were, you know, women that were going to opium dens. Some of them were women that were tangled up in the mobs, you know. Captain Billy's Whiz Bang, it was usually on the lighter side, but he would do some social commentary. And, you know, it also, he reminded everybody of the big change that Prohibition had made.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. And the bus back home sitting hand in hand when the evening ends. When the evening ends. When the evening ends. In Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.